Okay, so let's start. First of all, are there any questions about the homework or anything of that type? Last class, yes. Yes. Right. So what the purpose of that problem is to show you that for a given cost function, there might be pairs of strings where either good things happen or bad things happen. Okay, so what I wanted you to do is basically design a set of strings and a cost function, such that when you align those strings with that cost function, you get a unique alignment, and another set of strings and cost function that when you align them, you get a huge number of equally good alignments. Yeah. So basically, by alignment, I mean a path from the goal cell going backwards. So the alignment is the actual matching of the symbols. Okay? The goal cell has a particular value. That's the cost of the alignment. There is only one optimal value for that. Okay? But there may be lots of ways of getting there with any particular function and cost comparison function and pair of strings. One goal cell is an exponential number of paths that will achieve that cost. That's really what I want you to find. Okay, any other questions? Question six was about super, was that the one about superstrings? Okay, so the question there is, I got an email from the effect that they choose it. Basically, what I want you to do is design a pair of
Any questions about that? Okay. Yeah.
contemplate to solve my vaguely similar methods to what you have learned. Okay? Any other questions about the homework? Okay, the homework is due on Tuesday. I cast out project sheets last class, so some of you have started to come back up to me to talk to me about possible projects. I think that is a good thing. Okay, so you had till the 14th to come up with a proposal. So about 2 more weeks to come up with a proposal of what you need to do. Any questions? Also, this is an announcement to keep in mind. A week from today is going to be our field trip to the DNA Sequencing Center and Microarray Center. So I will send out email over the sort of the course email list of where it's going to be, because I think you guys should meet over there. It's going to be in a building in the health center, across Nichols Road. That is a difficult building to get around if you've never been there before. So I encourage you to follow directions carefully and be expected to get lost. How many people? Is there anybody here who has not gotten my occasional emails of, let's say, talks and things like that, meaning that I don't have your email address correctly? Does anybody who has not gotten email from me before make sure that I know this and get that incorrect email address so I can send you that address? Any questions? Okay. So what I would like to talk about today is we've been talking about cluster analysis. Okay. I mean, because I've been having a big section on microarrays and microarray analyses. We sort of agreed that with using these microarray data sets, you have to use multiple microarray data sets on a particular set of genes, what you end up getting is a big matrix. Okay? Let's say something like this. Again, this is a little bit blurry. It looks a lot better in color on the screen. But this over here is an example of a microarray data set that comes from analyzing a lot of yeast data. Okay? The rows of this matrix represent different genes. The columns represent different microarrays. Okay, so you ran a microarray under, maybe, you do something to the cells, okay, and then you take a time measurement every 10 minutes after you have zapped the cells to see what happens. Or maybe you put the cells in different conditions. You expose the cell, your yeast cells to some stress, like let's say heat or rock music or something like that. Okay, and certain genes will turn on and off in response to that. What your basic data set that you're coming out with from this is a matrix where the ijth point is the value of the ice gene at the jth microarray. Okay? And trying to make sense of data like this is obviously very complicated. I mean, we live in a world where there's 6,000 yeast genes. There are, I believe, something on the order of, at certain places, they have run at least 30,000 different microarrays of yeast data under different conditions. So if you really want to understand everything about that data set, you could have an array that is 6,000 by 30,000. More often, it's probably something like 6,000 by 10 or 20 or 100, because these arrays are each costing you money, especially if you're buying some Affymetrix. Okay? And the question that you most typically want to know is, what genes are similar, are doing similar things? Okay? The similar genes are probably co-regulated. Okay? And, or you may have one gene that you think is interesting. It's a protein that you think is important in, let's say, in what you're studying. You may want to know what other genes are there that behave similarly. So the first step that people typically will do in such an analysis, or the first meaningful step to try to mine this thing, would be to try to do some kind of a clustering analysis on these arrays, to break the genes into subsets with very similar expression. Okay, and here is, again, an example of a cluster analysis of a real data set. Here you see, this actually, although this may look difficult to read so far, in fact this is already clustered. Okay, on this particular data set. So you can see that there are regions here
And if you look at this very carefully, this is not really random noise. You'll see that there are large runs of genes with similar patterns. And when you blow these things up, you'll see that there are clusters here which have very similar expression behavior. Okay? Although, you know, how similar this is something that, you know, it depends what you're looking at. It basically looks like under all these conditions, most of the genes were turned off. Under these conditions, it was usually turned on. Then it was basically off, on, off, on, off. Okay? So this is the kind of pattern you're looking for. And it should convince you that these are fairly subtle patterns. Okay? These are not perfect matches that you're looking for. Okay? But the goal is to break them into clusters. And with this particular cluster analysis, the reason why the person who did it was very happy was when they actually looked at, in this particular picture here, they also annotate each cluster, each gene, with what the name of the gene is and what its known function is. And again, you can't read this on the, you might be able to read it, although very, very barely. But if you look at these things, all of these things are, you know, have very similar annotations, at least to the eye. These are all proteins, and these are some other genes that are known or not known. And so the hope would be that by when you compare these things by their behavior, you can look at what else is known about the gene. You know, it's, you know, what, you know, and maybe identify patterns and say, oh yeah, these guys are all have similar patterns because they all do the same thing. Or maybe when you build this clustering, you'll say, oh look, these all do the same thing, except there's this other weird gene in the cluster. I don't know what that one does. Maybe it does the same thing as all these other ones do. And that's kind of why you would want to run these kind of cluster analyses and what you hope to get. Okay? So any questions basically about clustering, the basic vision of clustering, why this is an important job. Okay? The other thing we talked about last class was we suggested the first algorithm, one class of algorithms, we looked at some of the reasons why clustering is hard. You have to decide what you mean by a cluster. Okay? Looking at these, we sort of agree that these look like clusters, although it's not obvious, you know, what makes this different than that. You know, it depends upon, you have to have some intuition of what you're looking for, and that's one reason why clustering is somewhat of an ad hoc problem. You know, it depends upon what your data, how good or bad your clusters are likely to be. Okay? So you've got to know how to interpret that. But last class we looked at one sort of basic class of clustering algorithms, the agglomerative clustering algorithms, which worked by, once you had determined a distance function between genes, okay, and a distance function between clusters, you could now repeatedly take a look at your genes. You start out with all your genes as being in separate clusters. You find the two closest pairs of genes, merge them into one cluster, and then repeatedly, the basic iteration is find the two closest clusters, merge them together to create another cluster. Okay, and those are the agglomerative clustering algorithms. We talked about them last time. Okay, they're very widely used. They're also relatively simple. I think that's pretty clearly understood. Any questions? Okay? So I'd like to talk today about a couple of other ideas or approaches to clustering, okay, which are you also hear. Okay, so some of which I think are kind of interesting. One technique you hear people talk about a lot in clustering, as a clustering method, a sort of a practical heuristic clustering method, is something called a self-organizing map. Okay, and this is sort of an idea where if you know how many clusters in advance you're looking for, okay, it's sort of an iterative method that is going to try to converge on your clusters once you have them. So basically what you might do for a self-organizing map, okay, is you have a set of endpoints in advance. You know you want to end up with k clusters at the end. Okay? You start out by picking k points, either at random or however you wish to pick them. Random seems like a good way to do it. Okay? And say that every point in the data set, okay, is now going to be assigned a representative point as defining its cluster. Okay? So maybe we'll start out with every cluster is going to have a point, a single representative point associated with it, maybe a median or a centroid or something like that. We start out by picking k points at random, if you wish, and assign those to be the representative of each cluster. We now make a pass through all the data points and assign each to be the each to go to the the nearest one of your k representative points. Okay? And this is now going to, now you've got a clustering based on your random representatives. Now you take each one of your clusters and somehow average them, the points within that cluster, and average them to determine a center point for it. Okay? And then repeat this process. Okay? So you're going to start out by, again, the basic picture.
I think it's not that complicated. We start off, let's say that we want to, we have a set of three clusters here. In real life, those are three clusters. Let's say we want to find those three clusters. Well, with this kind of algorithm, we'll start off by randomly picking three points. Okay? Let's say this one, and this one. Okay, that was not very lucky where you picked them. And now assign every point to its closest neighbor. Okay? So what is going to happen in this case? Something like this cluster may exist, This cluster may consist of that. This cluster may consist of that. Okay? Now we average all the points within each cluster to determine a new representative of it. Okay, so what's the average of these? Well, that's pretty clear. It's going to be that one. What's the average of these? Well, that's probably going to be someplace over here. What's the average of these? It's probably going to be someplace over here. And now we repeat the process. Okay? And now you triple nine. And now what are the clusters going to be? Well, these guys will probably cluster around here. These guys will cluster around there, and those will cluster around there. And so now the centroid of this is going to be this, the centroid of this will be that. We're starting to get something that looks about right. Okay? So the idea of a self-organizing map is that we're gonna,
you know, that the points somehow migrate towards, somehow naturally suck themselves up into clusters, okay? It self-organizes. This is sort of the buzzword here. Okay, yes?
I believe you have very good examples of the self-organizing map is like the more complicated
because it forces the structure. Yeah, you can write it down, okay? What you're saying is actually quite probably true, so I'm not going to argue with that. Okay?
Well, this is essentially a meager K-means clustering because there are selected K centroids. But self-organizing them is more complicated because there are networking structure on the centroids. So we are saying that all this is the self-organizing method in a children. So let's say this is a match. So your point may be very complicated spread all over the board. So when your algorithm runs, when everything is completed, when it converges, all this mesh will actually kind of like spread out the algorithm points. And what step that's missing in the algorithm is when your points moving will actually affect the neighboring points. For example, if this point is moved, the points to the left, to the right, to the south, and to the north will also be affected. So you can put the Gaussian function.
Okay. I will argue, okay, what you're saying is undoubted, is correct and true. I'm not going to argue with that. The basic idea, I guess what I would say, again, if we just look at these at sort of as a high level, is it still a case where you're, somehow things are moving around, is sort of, I guess, the big picture here when I think about self-organizing maps or k-means clustering or all of these kind of things. Okay? And so this makes it a little bit different than the agglomerative clustering that we were looking at before.
Remember, in the Andromeda cluster, you made decisions and things stuck. Okay, you merged things and that was the end of it. Okay? Here there is a forming and breaking of clustering and there's a certain amount of iteration that is happening. And there's an infinite amount of variation you can use, different, you know, different tweaks you can use to this basic idea. Okay, and I'll argue that what you talked about would be a variant of this kind of an idea. Okay? And so what's good about this kind of a scheme, there are a couple of things that are both good and bad about these kind of schemes. Okay? One thing is that they are relatively simple to implement. Certainly the k-means clustering algorithm we talked about was relatively simple. Okay? It seems like it's, in principle, somewhat noise resistant. Okay, or relatively noise resistant. Because things are sort of, clusters are getting formed around big gravity, or chunks of gravity. Okay, that's potentially a good thing. One issue here that is kind of strange, different about this kind of a method, though, is you have to specify the number of clusters in advance. Okay? And that's not always an easy thing to do. Okay? In certain cases, it's fairly obvious. So let's say you're classifying patients into healthy and sick. Then two clusters is probably a good number. Okay? But for example, if you want to try to cluster genes by performance, you know, by what they do, there is no reason to believe we don't really know how many clusters there are in advance. Okay? So there are different ways you can deal with this kind of an issue. One is, you try, pick a particular K, you try it, you see what happens, and you decide if you like or don't like your clusters. Maybe you vary different values of K. Second, there are various statistics you might use to measure how happy the points are with a given number of clusters. Okay? So you might, for example, compute the mean squared error. Okay, or how far is every point on the mean of every point, the distance of every point from its representative center. Clearly, as you add more points and create more clusters, the error that you get, the average distance that a point is from its center, should go down. So a clustering by that measure can always get better, should get better as you add more and more points. Okay? But on the other hand, you can sort of figure out, is the improvement you get by adding one more cluster worth doing? Okay, worth the reduction in error. Okay? Does everybody see that it's principle if you start out with a set of points and the target is sort of take up these limited points and cluster everybody by their distance from them? The more clusters you have, the closer on average every point is to a center of the cluster. Okay? They think it must do a bad job of assigning those centers. The more clusters you have, the more likely it is somebody's going to be close to one. Okay? But you can sort of start to measure how much better is your clustering as a function of how many points there are. And that might give you a measure of how much better, okay, how many clusters you have. Okay? But picking how many clusters you have is usually somewhat of a nebulous thing. Okay? How do we solve the problem of how many clusters do you have with the agglomerative clustering algorithm? How did you figure out how many clusters you have when we did that kind of an algorithm? Well, we didn't quite do it, because in the end we ended up with one cluster, right? Remember, we started out with individual elements in their own, you know, as individual clusters. We repeatedly merged them until everybody was merged into a data set. What you ended up with was a tree, naturally come up with a number of clusters. You don't have to tell it how many clusters. It'll figure that out based on the data set. Any questions? Okay, so these are the kind of subtleties that you have to worry about. Another class of clustering program algorithms, okay, that I find kind of interesting, are what you would call graph theoretic clustering methods. Okay? So, one thing you can try to do if you want to cluster a bunch of, let's say again, we are our if elements of interest are G's, and we want to cluster them by expressing. One way that we might cluster them is by building a similarity graph, okay, where the vertices are going to be our genes, and there is going to be an edge between the elements, the genes I and J, if and only if we decide that I and J are similar enough
that they should be, or can be, or likely are in the same cluster.
Okay?
And now we have a graph where, you know, basically, again, there's links between vertices that are close to that are close together, that are similar. If we do have an underlying cluster of things, things that behave themselves, if we have this function, and our similarity function was, our measurement of similarity was perfect, let's say that there really was a clustering of those genes.
Okay, out there.
And let's say that our function to decide, are they close enough that they should be in the same cluster, was always perfect. What would the similarity graph look like? Okay? There would be a vertex for every gene. There would be an edge between every two vertices that are in the same cluster. What would that graph look like? On a perfectly, if it perfectly reflected the clustering that was out there. Okay? Yeah. Lots of disconnected components.
Okay? So first of all, we would expect that things that are not the same, that are, if these are the two real clusters, if our similarity function was correct, there should be no edge between pairs of points from different clusters. So we expect different isolated components.
And within one
component, we would expect it to be fully connected. We would expect that we had an ideal perfect similarity function that what we're going to get from this kind of similarity graph is a collection of disjoint complete graphs, or cleats. Okay? And if that happens, then the act of finding the clusters is very, very easy. Okay? You just run connected components algorithm on that graph or something like that. Okay?
So if you can define a function that is perfectly correct, the clusters naturally fall out of your distance function, your similarity function.
Does everybody see that?
What might be a reasonable similarity function? Let's think about this.
What might be a reasonable similarity function on genes? Okay? Okay? Maybe that the distance is adequately small. So you'll say that if we're measuring the distance, you know, the distance is less than 0.1, or whatever it is between these two. Maybe if you're measuring correlation, the correlation between the two genes is greater than or equal to 0.9 or 0.8 or 0.7, something like that. Okay?
And if you get a similarity graph like that, the sort of graph theoretic clustering methods take this underlying similarity graph,
which could be weighted. You could have the edges actually have a weight proportional to how far apart they are, or unweighted. Yes, this edge just reflects that they're close enough that they should be in the same group.
Okay? And then these methods analyze the graph to try to identify interesting subgraphs.
Interesting subgraphs likely reflect clusters. Any questions about that approach? Okay? The computer scientist, this sounds like a nice, satisfying thing because you learn about graph algorithms and you want to do graph algorithms and graph algorithms have names that we can deal with. Okay?
So, for example, what if we wanted to find, we agree that if we have a graph like this, let's say this was our similarity graph.
Okay?
And let's say that our similarity function was loose enough
that it always was correct when we put an edge in there. That if we put it, that if edges I, elements I and J are in the same cluster, there definitely is an edge there. Okay, but sometimes it's over generous. It may put edges between things that are not in the same cluster. What problem is that if we want to now try to identify clusters? Okay? So suppose to say that our similarity function lies to us only in having maybe extra edges. Okay? But if there is supposed to be an edge there, it always has it. What problem do we know that our real clusters have?
Yeah, other nodes in that cluster should not connect. You can have at least one edge not accepted, but you can't have all edges on the same cluster.
So the assumption is, I think, what you're trying to say is that we know that within every within any cluster, if it's not lying to us, we have a complete subgraph or a clique formed. There might be spurious edges, but hopefully if we have an interesting cluster, it is unlikely that another element is going to be connected to all these guys in the clique. Okay? So this problem reduces to finding sort of large, complete subgraphs in the graph. And that's a way to identify a cluster. What's the problem with this method of looking for the largest clique in a graph, though? The famous NP-complete problem.
Okay? So, in fact, this gives us a nice characteristic of what a cluster is. But, unfortunately, finding the largest clique in a graph is hard to find.
Okay? So that's one drawback with this kind of method. It's even hard to come close to finding it, if you study the approximation theory of algorithms. So that's one drawback with this kind of approach. What's another drawback with looking for cliques in this graph? Okay, so we want to find clusters. Okay, let's say that I'm good at finding cliques. Okay, yeah.
Right, so I'm sort of, it's a fairly strong assumption to make of my distance function to guarantee that it never lies to me. About which, that if it says that two things are, that if two things are in the cluster, they in fact, it always says so. Okay? The only distance function I can think of that would guarantee that property would be one that for any pair of genes says that it's, they're in the same cluster. Then it would never lie to you. Okay? Lie in the sense of giving you a false report. I mean, it would never lie to you in that any real cluster would represent a clique in the graph. Okay? But of course, it's not a very useful function for identification. So in fact, you really want something that is not looking for cliques, but for dense subgraphs in the graph.
Okay?
That doesn't mean that the algorithms get any harder, it gets any easier. It means that the problems get a little fuzzier and well-defined. What do you mean by dense? Okay? What do you mean by this? Okay? In the worst case, these things are going to degenerate into cliques, so they're still going to be NP-complete type problems. Okay? But there's also some fuzziness, so we can start to look for approximations. Okay? Any questions? Question? Okay. Again, the idea that sort of somebody can have an edge between closest pair, every point to its closest pair, those seem like likely things to be in clusters. Okay? Although it's no real guarantee of that. Okay? We don't know what a cluster is ill-defined. Your other notion was on which point is farthest from somebody. It is likely that for every point, it should be the case that the point that's farthest from it probably should not be in the same cluster as it. Okay? And so you might imagine using longest and shortest distances as to help you make the similarity function in the real graph. But again, there's no guarantees. And there's a lot of edges that will not, that will be defined between pairs of points in a real cluster. So if you're defined to something that is not your closest point, and a lot of things that you're going to be going to that are not in the same cluster, such that it's not the furthest point. That's not a complete characterization you were given, but maybe might augment, you know, my decision, help me choose what edges I put in here. Okay, my basic problem is no matter how you construct that graph, you're going to be making mistakes. And so I can't count on finding cliques, okay? I can't count on not having edges between two elements in the same component, okay, between two different components, okay? What I really need to do is to try to find interestingly large, dense graphs, components in the graph. Okay? What? Almost dense, where almost is what you, it's hard to, what do you mean by almost? Does it mean missing one edge, two edge, or half the edges? Or two-thirds of the edges? Okay? You need to find large, dense graphs. Okay? Any questions? Now, most of these kind of problems of finding large, dense, or dense graphs tend to be NP-complete. There's one kind of cute example of an algorithm that finds a large, sort of dense graph, the largest sort of dense graph, efficiently. Suppose we want to find, let's say that we believe that in a dense graph consists of
subgraph consists of a subgraph. Each of them is connected to at least k other vertices in that subgraph, right? Okay. If we had a leaf size of n, then everyone would be connected to n minus one other five choices. Yeah. Well, let's say that the algorithmic problem I want to say is you give me k. A constant or an input. K is not a constant in the sense of being 2 and 3. It's a constant in the sense of being n. It's something that you give it as input. You might have imagined an algorithm to solve the following problem.
Given a graph, tell me, does there exist an induced subgraph, okay, anywhere in the graph, such that just those vertices, the induced subgraph, every vertex within that that subset of vertex is connected to at least k other ones in that subgraph. Okay? So, for example, here, if we asked in this particular example, if I wanted to isolate that clique, if I want to know, is there a subset in that graph of vertices such that every one of the vertices in that subset is adjacent to four other vertices? In fact, the largest subset of vertices in this graph, that such that every vertex is adjacent to four other ones, would be that clique. Right? Does everybody sort of agree with that? How do I know that? Well, first of all, there's no other vertex in here. Let me not be so quick to say that. Okay? In this particular graph, we have a graph where every vertex is of degree greater, subgraph has vertex degree greater than or equal to 4, right? I claim that you can algorithmically take any graph and find the largest subgraph, the largest set of vertices, such that every vertex in there has degree greater than or equal to 4. How would we do that? Well, actually, in this graph, is that true that everyone has degree greater than or equal to 4? No, okay? There's some vertices here that are of degree 3, right? So how can I find that graph? Okay? Then I can do this iteratively by saying this vertex here can't be of degree greater than or equal to 4, right? In the subgraph, because its degree is 3, right? Once I delete this one has a vertex of degree 3, right? Once I have this one has a vertex of degree 2. That one's going to get wasted, okay? If I keep, by that argument, if I keep deleting all the low-degree vertices,
okay,
and stop the moment my lowest degree vertex is of degree 4 or greater, I claim that will give me the largest possible subgraph, induced subgraph, whose minimum degree is k.
Okay? How do people sort of understand the algorithm or see what I mean? How do people don't see what I mean? Okay, an induced subgraph is graph theoretic speak for the graph that is defined by a set of vertices. Okay? So suppose, let's say, an induced subgraph is the graph that you get by picking a set of vertices and taking all edges that are defined between those vertices. So if I pick just these 5 center vertices of my clique, the induced graph I get are all the edges between those or the actual clique. Okay? So that's what I mean by induced. Okay? Again, in this case, when we think about it, the vertices represent the things of interest, the genes. The edges represent the relations between them. Okay? And so any cluster is going to induce a dense graph. Okay? Any questions? Yes? If we wanted to delete the thing to get does the order matter? I will claim that the order will not matter in terms of size. Okay? But it might matter, okay, conceivably, okay, in terms of what you get as an outcome. This is something I have to actually think about. I'm not completely sure. The answer is guaranteed to be unique. Notice that in this particular graph, there are multiple vertices at the beginning. This one is of degree 3. Is there any other vertex of degree 3? That one there? Okay? I could delete this one first. I could delete that one first. Okay? The act of deleting that is going to lower the degrees of other vertices. Okay? And I claim... What? I claim it will make a difference. Okay? Let me just think about it. Suppose, let's say, in a proof of this, let's say that... Let me think about this. I want to say that in the limiting case where you have isolated... That might very well be true. It should be clear that this algorithm is going to yield the correct answer, because by definition we're never deleting a vertex that can be in the solution. Okay, every vertex we're deleting clearly has to not be in the solution. Okay, because if you're guaranteeing me that there is a that everything in this vertex that what I'm giving you is going to be an induced subgraph where every vertex has degree greater than or equal to k. Any vertices of lower degree than that can't appear in that. Okay? And likewise, if that can't appear in it, any of its edges can't be used to contribute to the degrees of any of the vertices in there. So we know that what we get left is going to be the largest such thing. Okay? This potentially gives you an algorithm to find large, sort of dense graphs. Okay? Although, it might be that, you know, somehow so it's not clear that this is the right definition of density, but it does have a definition of density that lets us find these things. Okay? That much I'll leave with. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So, for example, you could imagine a graph where, let's say that we have a graph here where we have a large big circle here. And each one of these is adjacent to 4 other guys within the circle, cycle. You have this large, very diffuse graph. Here you have a clique of size 5. Okay?
Both of these have the property that the minimum induced degree is going to be 4. But this is probably a more interesting thing that you may or may not uncover by looking at this. Okay? Everybody agree with that? Okay? By the principle, it points a way towards finding sense graphs.
A clique is defined as one where every vertex is an where all pairs of vertices are adjacent to each other. So a subgraph is just a graph where some vertices are adjacent to some other ones. Okay? So I think of a clique as sort of a social thing. Okay, you have a bunch of people who all know each other. Okay, that's sometimes in high school, that was called a clique. Okay, all these friends who knew each other. Okay, if every pair of people in this clique are friends, then they would define somehow a complete graph, subgraph, or a clique in the sub, in the friendship graph. Okay, so that's how I think of it. Any questions? Yes. Well, when might this or might this not work? So, in this particular graph, it worked very nicely to find that clique. Okay? In a world where there are a lot of small, relatively dense components, you might find a bunch of them. So you could try this algorithm with different values of k and see what you get. Okay? If, in fact, this graph had a lot of cliques of size 4, of 5 vertices like here, then all of those would be left after you ran them. Okay, so maybe you could imagine, use this algorithm to identify where the dense subgraphs are, and then find the connected components that remain. Maybe each one of those is a cluster. Okay, yeah. If you had a clique that was of one edge to another clique, then yes, that would get left in there. Okay? So if you had two cliques with one edge between that, this algorithm would be perfectly happy to say that's a cluster. Okay? That's not such a bad outcome, because you maybe could eyeball those and say, oh, those really are two clusters. But that's one thing that would fall out of this algorithm, yes. Okay? Any questions? What? In that case, what you could then do, you're saying, what if I toned it down? I'll claim that it's got to be that you could solve that problem by finding a smaller value of k, because these guys are all still going to be connected. If you pick a smaller value of k, you might just enlarge the resulting size of what you get.
You have two cliques, and there is only one edge between this
cliques. Yeah.
So, if the clique size is k, or each of them,
this edge between them is going to mean two of the vertices have to have degree k plus 1. Yeah. So they are happy to be in the graph that we find here. Okay?
But if I decrease k by 1, then...
If you decrease k by 1, all that you're going to do is getting more. So if you think about it, that the higher you raise k, the more edges you're deleting. Okay? So you can kind of think of it as as you raise k, you get more and more garbage. As you lower k, okay, you're getting less selective about the graphs that you're taking. And so more and more edges and things will come in. So lowering k will only increase the size of what you get. Raising it in that case won't actually help you in any way. Because there's not going to be, if you think of your graph, you have two cliques of size k and one edge between them. What's the largest subgraph that has an induced, where the induced subgraph has degree k plus 1, the answer is no graph. Okay, you would melt away every vertex in the clique, and then that final edge is going to go away also. Okay? Any questions? So imagine this is actually a useful experiment to think about to show you the kind of artifacts that can come up in this cluster. Again, somewhat of an ill-defined problem. Okay? And you got to realize it's going to be artifacts like this that will come up. Any questions? But again, there's some other sort of graph theoretic ideas that can be used for clustering. Okay? So another way to think about a clustering, let's say we have a look at this graph here. Here we've got a nice dense graph on 6 vertices, a nice dense graph on 6 vertices. Okay? One thing that's interesting to separate those clusters is that you note by only deleting those two edges, suddenly you get left with two clusters that are both dense. Okay? So one other thing to think about, if we think about the similarity graph, is if we have a real cluster, within the cluster everything's going to be tightly tied, connected together. If we have a good similarity function, there's not going to be that many edges connecting the real clusters. Okay? It's going to be basically junk. We might want to ask, can we find a small number of edges to delete such that what we get left, okay, is disconnected? Okay? So one way to sort of uncover the fact that these are two separate clusters would be to note that if you delete only two edges, then the graph becomes disconnected. Okay? And so another graph theoretic criteria you might want to think about is trying to find the minimum edge cut, the smallest number of edges, which will disconnect the graph. Okay? And what gets left are likely clusters. Okay? Now, fortunately, finding the smallest number of edges to delete with this property is a polynomially time solvable problem. Okay? It can be solved using an algorithmic technique called network flow. It's a relatively advanced technique, but not, you know, I mean, people, you know, it's a well-known technique, okay? And there's a famous theorem that, so the network flow problem says, given a graph where all the edges are thought of as being pipes, okay, perhaps they are water pipes, okay, and they have a certain thickness to tell you how much water can flow through that pipe. You might want to ask, the network flow problem says, how much, what's the maximum rate at which water can flow between vertex S and vertex T, given that we've got a network of pipes? Okay? And if all the pipes are deemed, in this particular example, if all the pipes are deemed as having weight 1, okay, I would argue that, in fact, the maximum amount of flow you can get from S to T has to be at most 3. Why do we know that the maximum weight from a flow, if all the white pipes have weight 1, how do we know the maximum flow from S to T? Is it most 3? Yeah. There's only 3 edges coming into T. And so if we cut this here, okay, we cut, by cutting 3 edges, snip, 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 we eliminate all the flow from S to T. Okay, so if water's got to get from S to T, it's got to flow through something. Okay? And so it should be clear that the size of the minimum cut is sort of an upper bound as to how much you can flow through the pipes. In fact, that bound is tight. Okay, the max flow min cut theorem states that the maximum flow between two pair vertices is the same as the minimum edge weight needed to separate S from T. Okay? And so once I tell you that there is a fast algorithm for computing network flows, that will give you a fast algorithm for finding the smallest number of edges to delete, to disconnect the graph, disconnect S from T. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So how might this idea be used for sort of cluster, identifying an interesting cluster? We could potentially say, try all pairs of vertices in the graph. Find what is the smallest cut set to separate them. Okay? If that cut is sufficiently small that it looks like that's less than we would expect the support for a cluster to be, let's actually cut along those edges. Okay? Otherwise, So basically, we look to see what is the smallest cut set and cut that out, okay? And because those things are probably not in the same cluster. Any questions? Okay? What might be a limitation of this idea of trying to identify clusters? Let's look at a good example here. Could we find a good cluster in this set? I mean, you know, could we remove, is it the case that the clique we have here, is that the most densely connected part of this graph? I'll claim the answer is yes. Okay, this particular vertex can be disconnected from the other at a cost of deleting three. Okay, I can't disconnect this guy from any of these without a cost of being at least one, two, three, four, you know, at least four. Okay? So I claim by analyzing the size of these cuts, I might be able to snip out things and identify interesting graphs. What might be a problem with this method, though? Okay? Why might the smallest cut set not actually be very helpful in removing, in identifying a cluster? Yeah? If the smallest cut set is very close to K, that might not be very interesting, right? Okay, so if you're telling me that you are looking for a, that's an interesting point. Suppose that there are graphic systems, large number of tightly connected things, with a lot of other edges somehow sort of living there. Okay? It might be the case that there's no way to disconnect anybody. Okay? This particular graph. It might be that the cheapest way to disconnect somebody might be to take off one of these vertices rather than snip out the whole graph. Okay? Does everybody agree? If we have a vertex here, which is a degree K, clearly the smallest subset of this graph has to be less than or equal to the degree of the slowest degree vertex. Why? We can only disconnect the vertex by killing the graph, by killing that lowest degree vertex. So somehow this method is going to be useful if you really have a lot of large dense components connected by relatively few edges. Then the minimum cut set is going to likely break it. Okay? But in fact, again, if I worry about the smallest cut that you find is going to cut off something very, very small rather than something very, very large. It's what we call large, it's what we can like to think the cluster is going to be. Any questions?
Question for
Mark.
Does
like, so what I think what you really want to do is to take the graph, your dream of a clustering is you're given the similarity graph, which is lightly connected because it's spurious edges. Your dream is to delete edges so that you get a relatively small number of fairly strongly connected components. That is what you'd like to have. Okay? And the problem is the smallest cut might actually, if you can find it, that if you have the following situation where our graph consisted of two components, two huge things, as they were n over, they were looking at a world where there were n over two vertices in this graph that were completely connected. N over two vertices in this graph that were completely connected. Okay? N over two plus one edges spanning them. Okay? And again, it's a relatively small number of edges, relatively, you couldn't put it on n squared edges spanning these two. Now the minimal cut of this graph is probably going to be one vertex getting sliced off, rather than that cut, which is a sort of this big, weak thing. Okay? And everybody sees that the minimum cut criteria does not factor in the size of the chunks that you get left. In a partitioning problem like this, you want there to be large chunks at the end. Any questions? Yeah. Decide if it's based on maximum degree and all these kind of things. Is it right? It depends upon what your graph clusters you're looking for. It depends what your graphs are like. Okay? So I can't answer one way or another if it's a good idea or a bad idea. Okay? But you can sort of look at the clusters at the end and see whether you're happy with them.
But the problem we have here is that just taking the minimum cut might give us small components. Okay? Yes.
Your notion of cutting, you could have a weighted graph, okay, where you measure the similarity between these two. And so maybe that all these guys are very highly similar. And these are just standing and thinking of a log edit, but this is a 0.6 edit, 0.5 edit, a weaker edit. Then the minimum cut in the graph will do a good thing, okay? So the thing is, you may have hope, you can go to the optimal work for weighted edit. Why that's not a problem. Okay? But you may or may not be happy with the end.
Okay? Any questions? So, somehow what the right graph theoretic idea that you want, okay, is something that I would call more of a graph partitioning problem. You want to try to find a set of edges, a large set of vertices, such that it is fair that a small number of edges will cut it apart. Okay? Maybe you want to find what they call the minimum separator. You want to divide the vertices into two halves, such that each size is n over 2 vertices, and you know the cut is as small as possible. Unfortunately, these kind of graph separation problems tend to be incomplete when you start enforcing that each component be fairly large. Okay? So maybe the simplest variation of these kind of partitioning problems is something that that is a max cut problem. Suppose I took my similarity graph, where I have edges between pairs of vertices that are closer together. Okay? Suppose that I were to disconnect those, delete those edges. Okay? I would replace suppose I take my original graph, where I have edges between pairs of vertices that are very, I deem similar, and I construct a complement, where I get a graph where I have the same vertices, but edges, if and only if they were not connected in the original. So let's say that my original data consisted of the vertices in one set here, where they're all tightly joined together, the vertices here where they're all tightly joined together. If I complement it, what am I going to get? In my original clusters, I now have an empty graph, right? If they were completely connected before, now they're empty. These two originally had no edges between them, now there are edges between them. Okay? Suppose in the complement graph, I now look for the maximum cut in the graph. The edge, the cut that will cut the maximum number of vertices, the edges. That cut is likely to be interesting to me. Why? The maximum cut is going to have the property that it's going to cut the most non-edges of my similarity graph. Why can't my maximum cut have all the vertices on one side? Okay, in one cluster. Okay, that was the problem minimum cut, right? Because I might end up with one vertex by itself and all the other vertices separated. Why is maximum cut going to likely bias me to having big clusters? Okay. Well, because in order to get a large cut, I've got to have a lot of vertices on different sides. To get a cut, it means that I have a cut every edge that's cut has the property that the two vertices associated with that edge are on different sides of my cut. Does everybody see that? Okay. So in order to try to get a lot of cut edges, it's going to make sense. It doesn't do me any good to put all the vertices on the same side. Okay? Because I'm only getting points for edges that cross this cut. Okay? And that's going to argue that, you know, in general, it's going to want to put a lot of vertices on both sides. Okay, does everybody sort of see that? Okay. So the good news is that the maximum cut would likely reveal interesting structure. The maximum cut in the non-similarity graph. is likely going to reveal components. What's the bad news about that? Well, it turns out to be NP completes to compute the maximum cut.
Okay. So that's bad. But what's good about it? Okay, there are heuristics that do a pretty good job of defining the maximum cut in a graph. Okay? So one technique that we might be able to do for clustering would be something like this. Remember, agglomerative clustering, we started out with the individual elements, each as leaves. We then merge them together to create this tree. Okay?
With a graph partitioning technique,
we could have a clustering approach where we divide them into pieces. Instead, you start out with a dissimilarity graph.
You find a large cut in that graph. Okay, the maximum cut in that graph, or a large cut in that graph. Saying these two, all these guys are probably not in the same components as these guys. And just recur from there.
Okay, and now you've got two smaller problems. You're building up a tree from the root down rather than the leaves up. Okay? And that gives you another approach towards clustering. Any questions about that? Okay? So if you can find maximal cuts, this is not a bad idea. Okay?
I told you it's hard to compute in the worst case. Okay? But actually there's a certain amount of hope. Okay? Because there are heuristics that will come close to giving you the maximum cut, approximation algorithms.
Okay?
My favorite approximation algorithm for maximum cut is very, very simple. Okay? It randomly picks vertices as going on either, it flips a coin for every vertex and decides, are you going to go on the left or are you going to go on the right? Okay? And that's the entire algorithm. Okay? Now, why should that algorithm be any good? For any particular edge, does everybody see what the basic algorithm is? I start out with a vertex, every vertex here, I flip a coin. I have a head side and a tail side. Okay? Here I go heads, I flip this coin, it comes up heads, it goes on the head side. Flip this coin, it comes up heads, it goes on the head side. Flip this coin, tails, heads, tails, tails, heads, heads, tails. The head sides go on one side, the tail sides go on the other side. Okay? Does that seem like that's going to yield a good cut? Well, maybe not. Okay? But I claim that I can expect that that will cut half the edges in the graph.
Why is that?
What is the probability for any particular edge?
Here I have one particular edge in the graph. It's going to be connected between vertices I and J. What are the possible points of it that will cause it to go on either side? Okay, I'm going to either flip this one as heads, this one's either going to come out as tails, heads, or tails. What if this one might come up as tails? It's going to go heads and tails. In how many of these flips will I succeed in getting a cut that will cut this edge? Well, in this case where they both come up heads, I don't cut it. In this situation where they both come up tails, I don't cut it. But so long as they end up on opposite sides, okay, then I claim that I want to cut that edge. So by randomly partitioning the vertices, the amazing thing is I can expect to cut half the edges in my graph. Okay? Try to find the maximum total cut. Okay, it's empty complete. But guaranteeing me a cut that cuts at least half as many as the maximum cut can be done by this random flip. Okay, does everybody see that? Yeah. Okay, let's first finish with this one. This point here. Okay? So the interesting thing is this algorithm will give me a cut that I get late. Does everybody see that this cut will guarantee me a cut? That with high probability will cut half the edges of the graph. Okay? With a large cut, maximum cut. We'll cut the maximum cut with a large cut. Okay? Now, would this large cut be a good foundation for now doing our recursive algorithm, though? Okay? You say, no, why would that not be? It's a meaningless cup. It's a large cup, but a meaningless cup. Okay?
So, I didn't randomly assign them to different sides. They now recur and keep randomly assigning the different sides. I've got nothing. Okay? But I do claim that there are heuristics that can take a cut and make it better.
Fairly practical, simple heuristics
that could take a cut and try to make it better. Okay, so one idea might be,
suppose I start with a random cut. And I now ask myself, is there any vertex that will be happier if I move it to a different side of the street? Maybe this vertex here is connected to five guys on the other side. On this side, it's connected to six vertices. If I moved it to this side, it would make my cut larger. Does everybody agree to see that? So you can imagine taking a random cut and moving it around, the vertices around, to see which one is happier, and stop when there's no vertex that would make happier by moving. Okay? This, I claim, will yield a better cut, though not necessarily best. But derivatives like this will likely converge on reasonable cuts to use later. Okay, does everybody see that?
Lessons here. First is that we can use these graph partitioning approaches to do interesting things. Okay? Second, even though the problem's hard, there might be approximation algorithms
that guarantee us something close to the right answer.
Third, even though it guarantees us something close to the right answer, that might be meaningless. Okay? So we have to take our guarantees from these approximation algorithms with some salt. But on the other hand, there are heuristics that could probably get pretty good solutions. Okay, and all in all, this does lead to reasonable approaches for clustering kinds of algorithms. Any questions about the graph theoretic techniques? Okay, so we've reviewed several different kinds of graph theoretic techniques. Again, there's another technique, it's sort of a geometric technique, let me just kind of mention, which I think we've talked about. Sort of talked about this idea of using nearest neighbor clustering. Okay, you can take a point and connect it to its nearest, you can take each point and connect it to its nearest neighbor. Okay, and say the nearest neighbors are likely in the same cluster. Okay, and so this idea of doing nearest neighbor clustering makes a certain amount of sense. Okay, so one of the nice things, so basic idea would be that, again, we take a graph, a set of points, we connect nearest neighbors, we do that, and then maybe all the disconnected components would represent different clusters. One of the nice things about using this nearest neighbor classifier idea is that it gives us a way to let it, to say, classify whether something is, you know, it helped to, us to take our clusters and use them for classification later. Let's say that each one of these points represents a set of yeast genes, okay, that have been clustered by microarray data, okay, or by function or something like that, by similarity. Suppose another gene comes along and you want to figure out what is its function likely to be. You would might say, well, if each one of these points represents genes that we know their function of, maybe another gene that we now add, okay, the closest point to it might have the same meaning as, so we add another point to this data set, okay? A way we can ascribe meaning to that point is to say that it takes on the identity of the cluster defined by the closest point. Okay? So what's nice about nearest neighbor kind of clusters, okay, or clusters represented by points, is they naturally decompose space into cells around it. Okay? And these cells, if you know about geometry, these things are called Voronoi diagrams. But the nice thing is that they provide a way to classify unknown elements, okay? Which is often one of the things you want to do with clusters, okay? Any questions? Okay? Because somehow, in principle, once you've assigned every one of these points, the nearest neighbor idea will assign can successfully assign a label to every other possible value. Any questions? Okay? So, what's the conclusion? Okay, that's not quite the conclusion, but hold on a second. Sorry about this. I'm missing my. So what can we say in the end about clustering? Okay, just basic clustering algorithms. Okay, there's several different issues when it comes to clustering that you should keep in mind. Okay, one issue is how many clusters do you expect? We see the different algorithms. Sometimes they expect it as answers. Sometimes they expect it as part of a clustering algorithm. Sometimes it falls out of it. But somehow there's parameters that you have to tune to figure out that. Okay? One thing is that in viewing a multidimensional data set, okay, it is not, I mean, when we see these two-dimensional points on the board and these clouds of points, it's very easy to sort of see the clusters. But when you think about microarray data, where you've got, let's say, again, in the you know, you might have 10-dimensional data sets if you use 10 microarrays in your study, or 300-dimensional data sets if you have 300 microarrays in your study, okay? Trying to visualize and to get any sense of where the clusters are is a very, very difficult thing, okay? And so, you know, so learning how to visualize complicated data sets is an interesting point. An interesting subject. I strongly recommend some books by a fellow named Edward Tusty on visualizing data. These are some beautiful picture books showing how do you visualize, present data so that it's easily understood or completely obscured. Okay, and these are fun to read, and I encourage you to take a look at that. You have to think about how do you handle noise, okay, because depending upon your experimental data, you may have a lot of noise, you may have little noise. Okay, and somehow thinking about, you know, making your algorithms robust is sort of an important point. Okay? Finally, one decision you're going to have to make is what clustering algorithm should you use? And at least from my fairly limited experience, but some experience, is I'm kind of convinced that the choice of what clustering algorithm you may use is probably less important in most applications than the choice of what your distance function is, okay, and how you're processing your data to remove, you know, to remove noise. A lot of other decisions you have to make are far more important than I think the choice of clustering algorithm, okay? That doesn't mean that there's not a lot of people running around to sell you clustering algorithms. I mean, one thing I have heard is that I once read something that suggested that there are as many different clustering algorithms as there are people who have thought about coming up with clustering algorithms, okay? But these other things are also sort of important, okay? Any questions about cluster analysis or anything like that? Okay. What I think I'm going to do is next class. Actually, let anyway, I still have a couple minutes. Let me just show you two pictures from Tufte's book. Okay, I told you I like these books on data visualization. Let me show you something that will help maybe interest you with Tufte's book. Okay, this is a graphic on how you can view data in four dimensions. Okay, one technique for viewing data in four dimensions that I certainly would never have thought of that is very, very cute. So, if you look at what this technique, this sort of technique of so-called Chernoff spaces, okay, basically measures each dimension by uses a spatial feature, okay, to measure how some aspect of each particular feature, okay. So, for example, happiness, okay, is your smile big or little, okay? The size of your smile could correlate with how heavily expressed the first micro gene was in a particular microarray, okay? Or how big the eyes are and bright the R's might correspond to how heavily expressed was it in the second microarray. Or the pointy-headedness of it represents, depending on how oval, how elliptical the face is, might represent how strong it was on the third, how strongly expressed it was in the third microarray. Well, what's useful, maybe the spatial location, okay, might be another dimension, X and Y. Okay, this might be the fourth and fifth microarray. Well, what's interesting about that is you're trying to identify patterns. People are good at looking at faces, okay, and by looking at, an interesting cluster is going to show itself up as being a bunch of similar-looking faces, okay? So I sort of believe, hey, look, this looks like a cluster to me. These are a bunch of unhappy, big-eyed people, okay? And this guy looks very weird here. Here's a pointy-headed guy, when the pointy-headed guys were down there. So this might be a noise point, okay? And so my claim is that with proper visualization techniques, you can start to, that's an important part of actually analyzing these data, okay? It's not all statistical, a lot of it is getting a feel for it, okay? And I strongly encourage people to read Tufte's books just to get a feel for what data visualization looks like. Any questions? Okay, so next class I'm going to finish up the section on microarrays. I want to talk a little bit about software for microarray clustering. Microarray processing, and then we're going to start talking about structural biology, things about finding structures of molecules and things like that. Any questions? Thanks a lot. See you next class.